This week on Making Contact.
The dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were as much a warning to the Soviet Union as they were anything else.
In August 1945, in an action that has provoked controversy ever since, the United States dropped the first atomic bombs on Japan. On this edition of Making Contact, producer Reese Ehrlich looks at how the Hiroshima bombing set the moral and political tone for future aggression. We'll hear from both Japanese and American atomic bomb survivors and from today's anti-nuke activists. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information.
My fellow Americans, the sudden criminal attacks perpetrated by the Japanese in the Pacific provide the climax of a decade of international immorality. Powerful and resourceful gangsters have banded together to make war upon the whole human race. Their challenge has now been flung at the United States of America.
The country was pretty well unified behind the war effort.
Lincoln Grafs was 19 when he heeded calls from President Franklin Roosevelt and volunteered for the Navy. He says in those days, fascism posed a direct threat to the U.S. and others around the world.
When people tell me, you're so great, you're a hero because you were in World War II, my reaction is, well, so what? My whole generation was involved. There were 16 million of us. Quite literally, if you saw a man in his early 20s walking down the street in civilian clothes, he was abused in those days.
The entire nation mobilized for war. The country's corporations switched over to war production, making profits along the way. The government employed top scientists to produce an atomic bomb, fearing the Germans were close to developing their own. But after the Nazi surrender, the U.S. learned that, in fact, the Germans had no real atomic bomb program. John Dower, a history professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, picks up the story.
By April 1945, the Germans were out of the war, and we couldn't stop because we now had the new weapons. After the Germans surrendered, we redoubled our efforts because we were afraid the war would end before we could bring this to a conclusion. Then you get into incredible what we call technological imperatives, psychological imperatives.
On August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima and 3 days later used another on Nagasaki. President Harry Truman addressed the nation on radio.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians.
Historians know now that was a lie. Hiroshima contained a few military factories and soldiers, but the city was not a military base. The U.S. dropped the bomb on Nagasaki because the original target city was obscured by bad weather, and the pilot was running out of fuel. Over 200,000 people were killed in the attacks, mostly civilians. Truman's speech was just the opening shot in a propaganda war to explain U.S. good intentions to Americans and others around the world. The reality was quite different. Retired Nagasaki school teacher Masahito Hirose explains that the bomb exploded very close to where he is now standing.
The actual bomb exploded 500 meters above the ground. So this is really right underneath where it exploded because it was up so high. In the ground, playing ground right behind us, there were about 1,500 children who had just come out of the air raid shelters and were playing. They were all killed. Not a single one survived. And the heat was so intense that their bodies just burned within that second or two. They say when you look at this ground here now, if you came within several days, several weeks, the whole ground was covered with bodies. You couldn't see anything but bodies of children.
Sakue Shimohira lives in Nagasaki. For a time, when she was 10, she lived with her family in a bomb shelter, really a cave dug into the side of a mountain. After the Nagasaki bomb fell, she went back to try to find her house.
We found a broken gate pole, so we thought this was my house, our house. And we found a body, a charred body, under the rubble. And the body was covering eyes and ears with hand. We turned over the body and took off the hand of the face and found it our sister, elder sister.
Ms. Shimohira says the bodies continued to glow because the radiation affected the bone calcium.
Even 7 or 8 months after, the phosphorus light was given out from the ashes. It was called corpse candle.
The Nagasaki residents didn't know what caused the eerie glow. Some thought it was the spirit of the dead. Radiation sickness caused tens of thousands to die or be permanently deformed. Because the radiation damaged their chromosomes, many children of bomb survivors were born with birth defects or serious diseases. To this day, the U.S. government contends that the atomic bombs were essential to end the war and avoid American casualties that would have resulted from an outright invasion of Japan. At the time, authorities considered several alternatives, including issuing an advance warning or bombing an isolated location. In July 1945, 70 scientists who developed the bomb as part of the Manhattan Project petitioned President Truman not to use the bomb against Japan. Navy veteran Grafs, who today is a leader of Vets for Peace, says the bomb was aimed not just at Japan.
The dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were as much a warning to the Soviet Union as they were anything else.
While the Soviet Union was an ally against fascism during the war, sectors of the U.S. ruling elite were already laying plans to change that after the war. The bomb helped assert U.S. power around the globe and, in many ways, was the opening shot in the Cold War. But U.S. leaders definitely didn't want the world to know about the horrendous death and destruction of atomic weapons, fearing that the U.S. would be seen as an aggressor. Historian Dower explains.
So as part of a more general censorship policy, writings about the effects of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were basically censored by the American occupation authorities. Photographs taken by Japanese were ordered to be turned in to the Americans. And the film footage which the Americans took from the immediate aftermath of the bombs was held secret by the Americans until the 1960s.
And since journalists weren't allowed to file stories or photos from the bombed cities, the censorship effectively extended worldwide. A few courageous journalists, such as Australian Wilfred Burchett, defied the censorship, but most cooperated fully. One leading journalist for the New York Times reported on the atomic bomb while simultaneously writing press releases for the War Department about the lack of danger from radiation. Today, journalists in Japan say that had the press been doing its job, it could have undercut the nuclear arms race. Akira Tashiro is a veteran reporter for the Hiroshima Daily Chugoku Shimbun.
If the same thing had happened today with this advancement of media and technologies, if they televised the consequence of the atomic bombing right after the bombing for a few days or so, probably there wouldn't be the nuclear arms race between the United States and the former Soviet Union. Actually, the majority of the people of the world really don't know what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
While the U.S. government imposed strict censorship about the aftermath of the atomic bombs, its scientists were intently studying the victims. They learned that the aftereffects of radiation exposure were truly horrendous. Mr. Akio Shirakita was a teenager living in Nagasaki in 1945.
Since the explosion, I have been in and out of the hospital 17 times. So from above my knee, my bone was supported by metal. The artificial bones were added here inside. So I always suffer from the pain that I cannot explain. It is something like pressed by a heavy air pressure. And inside I feel some gas, poisonous gas.
U.S. scientists studied the Hibakusha, or atomic bomb survivors, as part of plans for possible future use of nuclear weapons. Then, beginning in 1946, the U.S. military subjected U.S. GIs to the same kind of radiation in a series of post-war atomic tests.
4, 3, 2, 1... The atomic bomb exploded at 8:35 a.m. Bikini time. I will make my first official statement on results in about 2 hours from now.
Lincoln Grafts was stationed on board a Navy salvage tug at the Bikini Atoll in 1946.
We were 9 miles away when each of the bombs was detonated. There were two bombs that summer. One was an airdrop. And then 3 weeks later, the second one was an underwater shot. After each one of those, 4 hours later, we were back inside the lagoon alongside the target vessels, putting out fires and doing whatever we could to keep the ships afloat so that survey crews could go aboard them later and assess the damage.
From their studies of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, U.S. military scientists were well aware of the dangers of exposure at a nuclear explosion site. Yet the Navy never informed its sailors.
In your early 20s, you're invincible, at least in your own mind. So we used to joke about things. We used to joke about being exposed to radiation. Ha, 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 you know, we'll go back and tell all the girls that we're sterile.
You got to act. Accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
We had no protective clothing. We were the first wave of manned ships back into that lagoon. We ran around that lagoon all summer. We pumped up the water that was contaminated with radioactivity and ran it through our evaporators to make fresh water that was used for drinking, cooking, washing clothes. We didn't have much choice. We were ordered to be there, and if we didn't like it, there was an awful lot of ocean to walk across between there and Pearl Harbor if we wanted to get away.
Within a few months of this intense exposure, some of his friends were showing signs of radiation sickness. Grafs himself developed a large abscess on his face.
I had a high fever, and they gave me a blood test and discovered that my white count was way out of whack. They gave me all the usual things like massive doses of penicillin and hot Epsom salts, soaks, and things like that, so nothing would touch it. And finally, one day, they took me down to X-ray, and this old Navy doctor said to me, "Son, we're going to give you when I was an old country doctor, they called it a hair of the dog that bit you." And they covered my eye with a lead shield, and they hit this thing with X-ray. I got two of those treatments, and the abscess went away. Somewhat later, my white count started evening out. Then, for the next 6 to 8 months, I had boils all over my body. Nobody ever told me that they connected it with radioactivity. In my service record, it doesn't say anything about radiation sickness.
The Army conducted similar above-ground tests in the Nevada desert, which exposed thousands of GIs and civilians to radioactive dust. Years later, Grafs wrote his PhD thesis on atomic test survivors. He found that 27% of vets questioned reported radiation-related illnesses. And, like the Hibakusha, the radiation exposure affected the next generation.
My daughter, who was conceived about a year after I was exposed, had trouble all through her teenage years with her endocrine system. She had half of her pancreas removed because of growths when she was 20 years old, and she ultimately died with a brain tumor. Her daughter, in turn, was born with a deformed foot.
But that's not what most Americans were hearing about U.S. nuclear tests and future use of atomic weapons.
Town meeting tonight from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Are you worried about the atomic bomb? Hear all sides and make up your own mind.
This town hall radio program was typical of the information Americans were getting in the early 1950s. The danger, they were told, came not from the U.S. use of nuclear arms, but from the Soviet Union's arsenal. Dr. Ralph Lapp worked on the Manhattan Project that developed the first atomic bomb.
Time is running out for us. Make no mistake about it, the Soviets are stockpiling A-bombs at an increasing pace. They have the bombers and the submarines and the agents to deliver the bombs to our shores.
In reality, the Soviet Union always had far fewer atomic weapons than the U.S. Now that the Cold War is over, historians say the Soviet Union never planned offensive use of atomic weapons. But U.S. administrations, both Democrat and Republican, had contingency plans to be the first to use nuclear arms in a confrontation with the USSR. And on several occasions, the U.S. or its allies came close to actually using them. Aaron Tovish, campaign manager of the Mayor's Campaign for Peace in Hiroshima, says that's what happened in the 1973 war between Israel and Arab countries.
Israelis were caught by surprise, and they got in touch with Washington, and Kissinger told them that, well, we can resupply you, but it's going to take a little time. And Golda Meir, through various channels, got back to him and said, we don't have time, we're arming our nuclear missiles, I just want to let you know it's that desperate.
Tovish notes that the Nixon administration speeded up the supply of ammunition and spare parts to Israel.
Israel was able to reverse the situation on the battlefield, and the missiles were taken off of alert. But there was a moment there where Israel at least appeared to be prepared to draw the entire world into a nuclear holocaust. This type of situation could develop again with any number of countries, and so we should be very thankful we made it through that Cold War period when there was such a level of readiness to launch massive numbers of nuclear weapons.
We'll have more about Hiroshima and its legacy in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Correspondent Rhys Ehrlich continues his report.
With the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1992, many people around the world expected the U.S. to significantly cut its nuclear weapons arsenal. After all, the existence of deadly Soviet missiles was the justification for the U.S. nuclear stockpile. But now, over 12 years later, the U.S. has torn up the anti-ballistic missile treaty, increased the efficiency of its missiles, and vastly expanded research into new battlefield nuclear weapons. MIT professor John Dower says that for many years, nuclear war was unthinkable for most Americans. Today, U.S. leaders are trying to change that.
The policy now is to say there is no clear distinction between conventional weapons and nuclear weapons. We have talked about developing nuclear weapons that can be what we call bunker busters. What a wonderful, benign term. We have broken all sorts of taboos. We now use routinely weapons made of depleted uranium without seriously discussing or permitting discussion of the effects of those weapons.
Aaron Tovish is the campaign manager for Mayors for Peace, based in Hiroshima.
How do you use a nuclear weapon against a terrorist? I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous. So if anything, the terrorist would welcome having a nuclear weapon used against them. Can you imagine a better martyrdom than being going up in a mushroom cloud? I mean, if Bush thinks that he can accomplish anything in the war on terrorism with nuclear weapons, he's got it completely backwards.
The U.S. spends an estimated $30 to $50 billion per year developing and maintaining its nuclear arsenal, money which could be spent to guarantee the future of Social Security or provide health care for everyone in the U.S. David Krieger is president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation in California.
There's no opposition party that raises these issues. If the government is content with the double standards that currently exist, where we and a few other countries have nuclear weapons, but others don't, there's no one challenging that status quo at a high level of government, and consequently the media doesn't do much with it.
The Bush administration has focused a lot of energy on trying to stop nuclear weapons proliferation, but only among countries hostile to the U.S. No such effort is aimed at U.S. allies with large nuclear stockpiles, such as Israel. But Aaron Tovish acknowledges it is important to stop nuclear proliferation everywhere.
If proliferation continues the way it has since 1995, with India and Pakistan coming out, with North Korea withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, questions about several other countries, the world is going to be in a very dangerous situation. And unfortunately, the nuclear weapon states, and here I would say particularly the United States, are not indicating that they would seriously like to go in the other direction towards nuclear disarmament. And so the future that they're presenting to the rest of the world is one where some people have nuclear weapons and others don't. And so every country is trying to figure out, well, am I going to be the one who has them or not? And that's not a good situation to be in.
The anti-nuclear movement hit its peak in the U.S. in the early 1980s when over a million people marched in New York, the largest political demonstration in the U.S. up to that time. While the movement has declined since then, every year, thousands of people in the U.S. and tens of thousands around the world gather on August 6th, the anniversary of the dropping of the Hiroshima bomb. This year, many of those events stressed the links between U.S. dropping atomic bombs and its aggression in Iraq. World War II veteran Lincoln Graffs, a leader in Vets for Peace, says the Iraq War is starting to look like the Vietnam War.
We've now created a mess that's going to be hard to undo. I think the sooner we recognize that it was wrong, accept the fact that it was wrong, and start making tracks to pull out of there, the better off we'll be.
The UN in New York will host a conference in May 2005 to review progress on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the agreement aimed at stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. Mayors for Peace plans to be the largest non-governmental organization attending the conference and will play an active role, says Aaron Tovish.
We're hoping to gather 100 mayors in New York, leading a delegation that will probably include yet another 100 cities represented by other officials. And this delegation will directly represent, through elections, directly represent more people than the vast, vast majority of the delegations, the governmental diplomatic representatives in the room. So they will speak with a great deal of authority.
Tovish says the delegation will present a statement adopted by the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
That statement calls on the President of the United States to support a decision to commence negotiations on the prohibition and elimination of nuclear weapons. They will have perhaps 1,000, 2,000 cities that have signed this statement, and they will therefore be speaking probably on behalf of more than 500 million people. We hope that this will give pause to the diplomats to raise up beyond this sort of baby step by baby step approach to nuclear disarmament and realize that they need an overarching trajectory to a nuclear weapon-free world.
Historian Dower notes that aggressive U.S. policy in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other parts of the world can be traced back to the dropping of the atomic bombs at the end of World War II.
We've crossed an enormous moral divide, and that we crossed that somewhere between the late 30s, when we said that this is uncivilized, barbaric behavior, and 1945, when we said there is no other recourse but to do this. In the present day, to look at people who then attack civilians and say, that is them but not us, is simply unhistorical.
Not far from Nagasaki's Ground Zero, children are gardening and cleaning up their schoolyard. The school curriculum here teaches the history of the atomic bomb and the peace movement that developed from it. A 10-year-old stops playing for a moment and answers the question, what does peace mean to you?
It means there's a world where there's no war, where there are no conflicts and oppression or discrimination, where we're friendly with each other.
For Making Contact, I'm Reese Erlich.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, produced by Reese Erlich for Peace Talks, whose executive producer is Barbara Simmons. The show is funded in part by the Bequest and Chase Funds and Newtown Monthly Meeting. Special thanks to Dr. Jennifer Beer, who helped with interviews in Japan. Thanks also to Andy Lancet at WNYC and the National Archives for use of historic audio. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production, funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. For a cassette or CD copy of the program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Marguerite Judson, development director, Brishan McKee, office manager, Dorian Taylor, outreach and distribution, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor. And I'm your host and production director, Amy Pomerleau.